Dream of the Red Chamber, Chapter 116.
Usually when we talk about reaching some kind of ultimate truth or, you know, experiencing a sudden revelation, we frame it as a victory.
Right. It's almost always an empowerment narrative.
Exactly. We imagine it as this single piercing moment of clarity, like waking up from a deep, confusing sleep, opening your eyes, and suddenly the fog is gone.
Yeah, you finally see the world exactly as it is.
And you're just, well, better for it. You have things figured out.
We assume that clarity inherently solves problems, you know? That understanding the universe gives you agency over your place within it.
But imagine for a second that you wake up, the fog clears, and you realize that every single thing you loved was actually an elaborate trap.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Like your family, your closest friends, your deepest romantic attachments. All of it was just a script written by someone else.
Yeah.
A mechanism designed to test you.
Which is a terrifying thought.
It really is. And the moment you realize this, you can never unsee it. You have to go back to the breakfast table, look your family in the eye, and pretend you don't know exactly how and when their lives are going to end in tragedy.
Right, because you have to just go through the motions of a life you now know is completely hollow.
That transforms the entire concept of enlightenment. I mean, from a supreme blessing into an absolute curse.
It creates a state of profound, insurmountable isolation. You are no longer a participant in your own life, really.
No, you become a hostage to your own awareness.
Exactly.
And that is exactly the terrifying, mesmerizing landscape we are walking into today. Bayou,
who essentially stumbles right into the backstage of his own reality.
Yes. He goes through this experience where the boundaries between the physical world and the spiritual realm just, well, they completely collapse.
He is forced to read the tragic, inescapable script of his life and the lives of everyone he loves.
And then he has to wake up. He has to go back to a mortal world obsessed with money problems, standardized exams, and family duty.
It is a stunning collision of themes.
We're going to explore what it means to be caught between life, death, and the ultimate realization of your own destiny.
We are examining an ethereal, deeply philosophical journey through the cosmos that crashes headfirst into the crushing bureaucracy of mundane life.
To keep that central question in the back of your mind as we go, if you discovered the ultimate chilling truth of the universe, how could you ever go back to caring about paying the rent?
Right. How do you function when the mundane and the infinite are at war with each other?
Exactly. And the source material doesn't ease us into it at all. It drops us right onto the absolute edge of mortality. Let's set that scene.
Because the contrast between the physical and the spiritual here is just staggering.
In the physical mortal world, it is pure, unadulterated chaos. Bayou is dying.
Yes, he has literally just fainted after hearing something his maid Sheyu said to him.
He falls backward. And to everyone in the room, it looks like he's already gone.
The physical descriptions provided in the text are incredibly precise, and they paint a deeply distressing picture.
It's not a peaceful slipping away, is it?
Not at all. His pulse completely stops, his jaw locks shut. You are witnessing a grand aristocratic household descending into absolute visceral panic.
His mother, Lady Wang, is weeping uncontrollably. Sheyu is so consumed by guilt over whatever she just said that she's making secret plans to commit suicide if he dies.
The stakes are incredibly high in that room.
And his father, Jia Zheng, is running around frantically. He's searching for this mysterious monk who had just been in the house and suddenly vanished.
It's loud, it's terrifying, it's the raw, heavy reality of human loss playing out in real time.
Yet, simultaneously, we are given access to the spiritual escape.
And the stark contrast here is what makes the narrative so compelling. While his family is screaming and crying over his lifeless body, Bayou's soul is experiencing something entirely different.
It's almost entirely detached from the trauma of his physical form. The text says he feels as light as a leaf.
His soul separates from the body, but not in a dramatic, explosive burst of light. He's simply hovering.
He just wanders out to the front hall,
yeah.
Seemingly unfazed by the screaming women he just left behind.
Right. And he sees that same mysterious monk sitting there.
And Bayou, in this state of newly separated consciousness, politely bows to him.
Which is such a bizarre reaction to your own death.
I know. You just politely bow to the stranger sitting in your living room while your mother is wailing in the next room.
The monk's reaction, or rather his lack of reaction, is equally significant here.
Oh, yeah. He doesn't say a word. He just stands up, grabs Bayou, and starts walking.
Suddenly, Bayou realizes he's floating. He's completely weightless, drifting like a leaf caught on the wind.
He floats right out of his grand wealthy estate and into a desolate, barren wasteland.
This sounds strikingly similar to modern accounts of near-death experiences.
Completely. You hear these stories from patients who flatline. They describe hovering above an operating table, feeling totally serene and detached.
Feeling weightless, while down below, the surgeons are screaming for paddles and the heart monitor is flatlining.
It's that exact same dichotomy.
Hmm.
The living were trapped in the heavy, terrifying reality of the physical body, while the person dying is drifting away from all of that gravity.
If we look closely at the source text, there is a very specific detail about his physical body that explains this tether between the two realms.
The physiological anchor, right?
Yes. Jia Zhang, in his frantic panic, touches Bayu's chest. And the text makes a point to note that while there is no pulse and his jaw is locked tight, his heart is still warm.
So the body is dead, but the heart holds on to the heat.
This warm heart is crucial to understanding Bayu's entire existential dilemma.
Because Bayu is famous throughout this narrative for his profound capacity for passion, right? For empathy, for emotional connection.
Exactly. He feels things deeply. That warmth is his core essence.
It's the literal and metaphorical anchor keeping him from fully crossing over into the void of death.
His physical heart is still stubbornly holding on to the mortal world, even as his soul is dragged into this barren wasteland.
But I have to say, I'm looking at this monk, this spiritual guide, and I'm really bothered by his behavior.
How so?
If he is a holy figure, why is he so completely indifferent to the immense suffering happening in that house?
That's a very human way to look at it.
Well, he literally just grabs Baiyu and leaves. He doesn't offer a single word of comfort to a mother who thinks she has just lost her son.
Right.
He doesn't absolve the maid who is planning to end her own life out of guilt. For a divine representative, it feels incredibly cold.
The coldness is deliberate, and it serves as our first introduction to the nature of the divine in this universe.
Okay, tell me more about that.
To the monk, the panic of the family, the weeping, the guilt, the frantic attempts to save a life, those are all just earthly attachments.
They're just allusions to them.
Exactly. To offer comfort would be to validate the illusion. The divine realm Baiyu is entering does not operate on human empathy.
Empathy is viewed as a flaw.
In fact, yes.
It's as if the universe is looking at this grieving mother and saying, your tears are irrelevant because the thing you're crying over isn't real in the first place.
That is the exact philosophical stance of the celestial bureaucracy.
Man, that is harsh.
Bayu is about to learn this lesson in the most overwhelming, systematic way possible as he crosses the threshold.
So Bayu and this incredibly aloof monk are walking through this desolate wasteland. And suddenly, rising out of nowhere, they arrive at a massive, grand archway.
And this isn't just a gate.
No. The source explicitly tells us this is the entrance to the true reality.
The characters inscribed on the archway translate to true reality or blessed land, but it is the couplet written alongside it that presents an absolute masterpiece of mind-bending philosophy.
It establishes the metaphysical rules of everything Bayu is about to experience, doesn't it?
It does.
I want to read the translation of this couplet from the source because it requires some serious unpacking.
Go for it.
It reads, "When false goes and true comes, true beats false. What is originally nothing is something. What is something is not nothing."
It reads like a linguistic maze, intentionally designed to disorient the mortal mind.
It really sounds like a riddle wrapped in a paradox. How is a human being supposed to process that standing at the gates of the afterlife?
It's definitely not straightforward.
What does this actually mean for Bayu's understanding of his own existence?
Well, it completely inverts what the listener in Bayu considers to be reality.
Okay, how
does... So up until this very moment, Bayu has lived in a sprawling, opulent estate, surrounded by immense wealth, intricate family politics, poetry, and profound romantic love.
Right. He considered that tangible world to be his real life.
But this archway is actively telling him that everything he just left behind is the false. The weeping mother, the warm heart, the physical body itself, that is all an illusion.
And this ghostly, dreamlike wasteland he's standing in, this invisible space, is the true reality.
Yes. When false goes and true comes, true beats false. This implies that when you finally strip away the sensory illusions of the mortal world, the ultimate, undeniable truth of the cosmos is what remains.
Wow. And what about the second half of the couplet?
What is originally nothing is something. What is something is not nothing. That speaks directly to the unseen architecture of fate.
The spiritual realm, which seems invisible or like nothing to a mortal eye, is actually the fundamental something that dictates everything else.
Exactly. The physical world is just a shadow cast by this invisible reality.
It's basically slapping him in the face and saying, "Welcome to the real world. Everything you've ever cared about was just a projection."
It's a brutal awakening.
And he walks through this archway and enters a palace. The architecture itself seems to be categorizing human behavior.
He sees different distinct areas.
Yeah, one is marked blessing the good, cursing the lustful. Another is called guiding the awakened, passionate fool.
Pay attention to that specific phrasing, the passionate fool.
That defines by you entirely, doesn't it?
It does. He is a young man driven by passion, by a desperate need for deep emotional connections with the women around him.
He is quite literally a fool for love.
This palace isn't just a location. It is an institution designed to awaken him from that specific foolishness.
He wanders into this dark, quiet room within the palace. It's filled with these massive, dusty cabinets.
And he opens one up.
Right, and he finds registers, ledgers. Specifically, he finds the registers of the 12 beauties of Jinling.
These aren't just books. These are the cosmic files, the foundational blueprints of fate.
He has literally stumbled into the cosmic writer's room. He opens these books, and he starts reading cryptic, poetic verses about the women in his life.
The people he loves more than anything else.
He sees a drawing of a jade belt accompanied by the character for Lin, which points unmistakably to his beloved cousin Lin Daiyu.
He sees a line about a gold hairpin in the snow, a clear reference to another major figure in his life, Bao Chai.
And he reads an incredibly sad verse about an actor's blessing and a young master's missed connection.
The source text notes a profound emotional reaction here. He actually cries while reading that line.
Wait, really? He starts crying right there in the ledger room.
Yes, realizing it speaks to a fundamental disconnect, a tragedy of timing and fate concerning his own life and missed opportunities. He is reading the sorrow of his own future.
Oh, man. And then the true horror of what he is looking at dawns on him. He pieces together a line about a great dream returning.
And it hits him.
He realizes it perfectly predicts the exact tragic fate of his older sister, Yuan Chen.
He reaches an epiphany that breaks his entire worldview. He says to himself, "It is so, the mechanism is flawless."
The mechanism is flawless.
Wow. He realizes that every single life, every fleeting joy, every devastating tragedy, every premature death was written down in these dusty books long before any of them were even born.
The ink was dry before they took their first breath.
Exactly.
We really have to pause and think about the psychological burden of this moment. Imagine finding a book that accurately dictates every illness, every heartbreak, and the eventual death of everyone in your family.
It's an unimaginable weight.
How does that fundamentally alter a person's concept of free will? If you know the future, does that make you a prophet with the power to change things? Or does it just make you a helpless prisoner of a script you can't rewrite?
That tension is the central philosophical weight. If we analyze his reaction, he doesn't feel a surge of heroic empowerment.
He doesn't think, "I know the future, I can warn them, I can save them."
No, he recognizes that the mechanism is flawless. The sheer crushing perfection of the cosmic design destroys the illusion of free will.
He isn't a prophet. He's just a tragic observer who has been accidentally granted access to the director's script.
It's devastating.
He's reading about their lifespans, their poverty and success, and he realizes none of it is up to them. They are just actors hitting their marks in a play they don't even know they've been cast in.
All they're struggling, all they're hoping, it's completely pointless.
And knowing this provides absolutely no comfort. It offers clarity, certainly. But it is a cold, clinical, terrifying clarity.
The universe operates on a ledger system, and his emotion has no bearing on the accounting.
Which makes Bao Yu's next actions so agonizingly human. Because he doesn't just read about his loved ones and accept it. He is in this spiritual realm, and he tries to actually find them.
It is the most natural instinct imaginable. You are in a strange, frightening environment. You've just been burdened with terrifying knowledge. Of course, you seek out a familiar face.
You look for an anchor.
Yes.
And he specifically looks for his cousin, Lin Daiyu. He wanders away from the ledgers and finds himself in this beautiful, otherworldly courtyard.
It's covered in incredibly pristine, magical green grass.
There are no flowers, but he is completely mesmerized by the sheer, unearthly beauty of it. And then, out of nowhere, the fairy guarding this grass appears.
The fairy of the Jiangsu weed.
And her first words to him, this poor soul who has just died and discovered the tragic fate of his family, are basically, "What are you doing here, you clumsy creature?"
Clumsy creature is a fascinating insult in this context. It reduces his human form, his heavy emotional, mortal existence, to something awkward and unrefined.
She treats him like a stray animal that wandered onto a pristine golf course.
That's a great way to put it.
She then explains the lore of this place. She says this magical grass, the Jiangsu grass, was once watered by a celestial being called the Xinying Attendant with sweet dew.
Because of that, the grass owed the attendant a debt.
And to repay that debt, the grass descended to the mortal realm.
I want to spend some time on this because it explains the exact mechanics of karmic debt in this cosmology. This isn't just a fairy tale backstory.
Right.
It is the mythological foundation of Baoyu and Lin Daiyu's entire relationship. Baoyu is the mortal reincarnation of that celestial attendant. Daiyu is the reincarnation of the grass.
I really hung up on this concept of watering a plant translating to a lifetime of weeping. How does that economy of karma actually function?
It's very literal.
Like, how does dew become tears?
It's a beautiful, terrifying mechanism of literal exchange. In this universe, emotional output is treated as a currency.
So the attendant gave the grass sweet dew the whole, a life-giving liquid in the celestial realm.
Exactly. To repay a celestial debt in the mortal realm, the currency must be translated into human terms.
Wow.
The grass, now reincarnated as a human woman, must repay the liquid debt with her own bodily fluids.
That is so dark.
Her entire life of weeping, her endless sorrow, her physical deterioration in the mortal world is simply the mathematical repayment of that cosmic debt.
Hmm.
Every tear she sheds for Baiyu is a coin deposited into the karmic bank.
That makes her mortal suffering sound so transactional. It completely strips the romance out of her sadness.
It really does.
But Baiyu doesn't fully grasp all of this heavy cosmic accounting in the moment. He just wants to find his cousin.
He's still operating on human logic.
Yeah. He asks the fairy, who is your master? Who is in charge of this place? She says it's the Xiaxiang consort.
And Baiyu's face lights up. He knows that title.
He says, that's my cousin. That's Lin Daiyu. Please let me see her.
He expects a joyful reunion. He expects the rules of human connection to apply in the afterlife.
But the fairy's response shatters that expectation brutally. She completely and utterly rejects him.
It's a harsh awakening.
She tells him to stop talking nonsense. She says, this is the realm of celestial beings. We don't have earthly family ties. We don't have cousins here.
She even threatens to call the divine guards and have him physically beaten and thrown out of the courtyard.
Just for suggesting such an inappropriate earthly connection.
The profound heartbreak of this scene cannot be overstated. Heaven, or the true reality, is not a place of warm reunions.
It's not a place where you get to hug your grandmother again or be reunited with your lost love.
The divine realm in this text operates on absolute, rigid detachment.
It's incredibly alienating. It strips away every comforting thought we have about the afterlife.
It does. Baiyu's defining characteristic, the thing that makes him who he is his profound love for his cousin. It is the core of his identity.
And here, standing in the ultimate reality, the divine views that love as inappropriate.
It's not just irrelevant, it's offensive. It's clumsy and entirely useless to the cosmic order.
It really makes me think of returning to your childhood home. Imagine going back to the house where you grew up, the place where you felt the most loved, the most safe, the most known.
A place of ultimate comfort.
But when you walk through the door, you find that the house has been bought by strangers. And they don't just not know you, they speak completely different language.
Right.
They look at your nostalgia, your desperate need to connect with the memories in that house, as an annoying trespass. They are threatening to call the police on you for standing in their living room, crying over a past that means absolutely nothing to them.
That captures the emotional violence of the scene perfectly, because to the fairy, his emotional attachment is literally a trespass on holy ground.
His desperate, messy human love is polluting the pristine celestial landscape.
He's bringing dirt into a sterile environment.
And this rejection completely shatters him. The text says he feels foul and dirty compared to these pure celestial beings.
So he turns and runs away.
And this is where the spiritual journey shifts from being coldly alienating to being an outright visceral psychological nightmare.
He begins his descent, the frantic flight back toward the mortal realm, and the landscape of his mind turns against him.
He is running, trying to find his way out of this spiritual maze, and suddenly familiar faces start appearing in the gloom.
But they are not the comforting faces he knew in life.
First, his path is blocked by Yu Sanji, a woman from his past.
Yeah.
and she isn't happy to see him.
Not at all.
She's wielding a sword, and she violently accuses him and his brothers of ruining women's reputations, of destroying their marriages. She declares she is there to cut him down.
She represents the physical manifestation of consequence, but it's important to understand the nature of the guilt she is projecting.
So wait, if he's generally portrayed as this gentle, loving guy who cares deeply for women, how are these monsters his own sins?
It's complicated.
Are they just the karmic bill for his family's lifestyle?
That is the fundamental terror of this universe. Individual purity doesn't insulate you from systemic rot.
Okay, unpack that for me.
Bayou is gentle, yes, but he is also the golden child of a highly privileged, deeply patriarchal family system that routinely consumes, uses, and destroys the women around it.
Oh, I see.
The women chasing him, Isanji with her sword, the maids, the cousins, they are the collateral damage of his existence. He is witnessing the destructive wake of his family's wealth and power.
Even if his individual intentions toward these women were pure, his very position in the hierarchy is complicit in a system that caused them immense suffering.
Precisely. So his subconscious is basically dragging him to cosmic court, forcing him to face the bill for his family's systemic oppression.
He cannot escape the collective guilt of his bloodline.
Exactly.
He barely manages to run from Yusonji, and then he hears a voice he recognizes. It's Kingwin, one of his favorite, most fiercely loyal maids.
And he is so relieved.
He cries out, "Oh, thank God, Kingwin, take me home. Save me." But she looks right through him, her face completely blank, and says, "I am not Kingwin. I am a divine messenger."
She denies her own identity. She erases their shared history.
The intimacy they shared in the mortal world is completely negated by her new celestial status.
It's terrifying.
He keeps running, completely lost, his panic escalating. He sees a group of his cousins, girls he grew up with, played with, loved, like Ying Chun. He desperately calls out to them to save him.
And right before his eyes, these beautiful, familiar girls suddenly warp and transform into pursuing ghost and monstrous creatures,
violently chasing him down to tear him apart.
The psychological horror here is that the things he loved most are mutating into the things that will destroy him.
And just as he is about to be completely overwhelmed by these manifestations of guilt and consequence, who steps in?
The monk. The same indifferent monk from the very beginning suddenly reappears.
He steps between Bayou and the monsters, and he holds up a mirror. And the light from this mirror instantly banishes the ghosts. They just evaporate.
The mirror is a classic symbol of spiritual clarity, reflecting true reality and dispelling illusion. But the monk's explanation of what just happened is the true turning point of the narrative.
What does he tell Bayou?
This is the line that recontextualizes his entire existence.
The monk tells Bayou that all of these terrifying monsters, all of these pursuing ghosts, were actually created by demonic barriers.
And what are those demonic barriers? They aren't sins in the traditional sense.
No, they are earthly romances, human attachments, the very passions Bayou thought were his greatest virtues.
The original text uses the term mozang, demonic barriers or karmic hindrances. The monk redefines Bayou's entire moral compass in two words.
Bayou had always believed that his empathy, his love, his deep emotional connection to these women were the highest possible virtues. He thought his love made him pure.
But the monk tells him that those exact feelings are the chains keeping him trapped in a terrifying, monstrous illusion.
The love he felt wasn't a virtue. It was the bait for the trap. It was the very thing generating the monsters.
This is such a staggeringly heavy concept. It forces you to reevaluate everything.
And I want to bring the listener into this space. Think about your own life for a moment. What are your demonic barriers?
What are the relationships, the ambitions, the deep emotional attachments that you cling to so fiercely that they warp your sense of reality?
We all have things we believe define us. But if you stripped away every single thing you are desperately attached to, your career, your relationships, your fears, what would actually be left of you?
It's a terrifying question because human identity is built almost entirely on those attachments. We are a collection of the things we care about.
To remove the demonic barriers is essentially to demand the total dissolution of the ego.
It asks you to stop being a person and start being a void.
And that profound dissolution is exactly what Bayou experiences when he wakes up. Because right after the monk delivers this crushing truth, he gives Bayou a hard physical shove.
Bayou falls backward, yells out in shock, and suddenly his eyes snap open.
The spiritual journey is over. He is back in his physical body.
The return to the mortal realm is instantaneous. The out-of-body experience ends, but the knowledge remains.
And the scene he wakes up to is just as chaotic and emotionally charged as when he left. His mother, Lady Wang, and his wife, Bao Chai, are sitting right next to his bed.
Their eyes are swollen red from hours of crying.
When he opens his eyes, they think it's an absolute miracle. They immediately send frantic word to his father that the crisis is over, that they don't need to prepare for a funeral anymore.
From the family's perspective, they have just gotten their beloved son back from the brink of death.
But Bao Yu's reaction is what's truly unsettling here. He doesn't match their energy. He doesn't cry tears of relief with them.
He doesn't reach out, hug his mother, and say, "I'm so glad to be back. I was so scared."
No. He just lies there, completely still, processing everything he just saw in the true reality. He realizes he literally died, read the cosmic script, and came back.
And as his mother and wife are weeping with joy over him, he just starts laughing to himself.
He's just softly chuckling, nodding, saying, "Yes, yes, that's how it is."
He has stepped behind the curtain of the universe. He sees the machinery now.
He remembers the ledgers perfectly. He looks at his mother, his wife, all the maids rushing around the room, and he knows exactly how each of them is going to suffer and eventually die.
He knows their destinies.
But he makes a conscious, chilling decision. He's not going to tell anyone. He doesn't warn them.
He adopts the role of completely silent, detached observer in his own life.
This marks a profound, irreversible shift in his character. He is now enlightened. He understands the nature of reality.
But enlightenment, as depicted here, looks incredibly similar to emotional death.
He is sitting in a room full of people who fiercely love him. But there is now an insurmountable, invisible glass wall between his consciousness and theirs.
And the text plays with this distance by weaving in these incredible moments of dramatic irony. The family almost figures out the cosmic truth, but they miss the forest for the trees.
Oh, like with the missing jade.
Exactly. The maids, Bao Chai and Sharon, are discussing a recent mystery. Bao Yu's magical jade amulet had gone missing a while back.
They remember that a fortune teller had predicted its location using the Chinese character Shang, which means reward.
For a long time, they didn't understand it. But suddenly, looking at it now, they realize it was a linguistic clue.
The top half of that character is Shang, which points perfectly to the word He Shang, which translates to monk.
They realize the mysterious monk was the one who took the jade.
It's a brilliant, tragic piece of linguistic determinism in the source text. It shows that the clues to the grand cosmic design are hidden in everyday language, right in front of their faces.
But the family is so completely focused on the literal physical object, the missing jewelry, that they completely miss the spiritual implication of the monk's presence.
They successfully solve the riddle of the stolen jade, but they remain completely blind to the riddle of their own existence.
The tragedy of foresight is so heavy here.
His cousin Xichen, who has always been very spiritual, starts talking to him about Buddhism. She quotes a mournful poem about sitting alone before a blue lantern and ancient Buddha, talking about the nobility of renouncing the world.
And the old Bao Yu would have debated her. He would have engaged in a deep, passionate, philosophical argument about the value of worldly beauty.
But this awakened Bao Yu. He just coldly laughs. He sighs and remembers a specific verse from the cosmic ledgers he read in the true reality.
A verse about one bed mat, one flower.
He knows this verse foreshadows Xichen's own tragic, lonely fate as an impoverished nun.
He knows her ending before she has even lived her middle. He hears her speaking of spirituality as if it were a noble, free choice. But he knows it's just the grim, inescapable destiny written in a dusty book in a celestial palace.
It's like being the only sober person at a party on the deck of the Titanic. You know the ship is going down. You have literally seen the blueprints of the iceberg and the math of the hull's failure.
But everyone around you is just arguing about what song the band should play next and deciding what kind of champagne to drink.
You can't even warn them because the ship is already sinking and the water is coming in, whether they know it or not. So you just sit there, sipping your water, completely and utterly isolated by your own awareness.
That isolation is the price of his cosmic awareness. And what makes it even more agonizing, what truly drives the tragedy of the narrative, is that the world doesn't simply stop just because he understands its futility.
The mundane machinery of mortal life keeps grinding forward, demanding his participation.
The pivot here is so violent, it almost gives you whiplash. Bayou has just had his entire metaphysical reality shattered. He knows that all earthly ambition, all wealth, all human striving is a demonic barrier.
And the very moment he is physically well enough to sit up in bed, what does his father, Jia Zhang, do?
He immediately pivots to logistics.
Pure, unrelenting logistics. Jia Zhang walks in and basically says, all right, you're not dying. Fantastic. Now we have a massive logistical nightmare to deal with.
We need to organize the escorts for the coffins of your old madam and your cousin Lin Daiyu back down south to their ancestral burial grounds.
The spiritual realm may be infinite and ethereal, but the mortal realm requires shipping crates, transport fees, and travel permits.
And the transport fees are a catastrophic problem. Jia Lian, the cousin who manages the household finances, comes in and drops a bomb on the family.
They're completely, absolutely broke.
The narrative contrast here is masterful. We move directly from the grand ledgers of cosmic fate in the Celestial Palace to the frantic red-inked ledgers of a bankrupt household.
Jia Lian lists off all their financial failures in humiliating detail. He says they can't squeeze any more money out of their official government job.
They can't legally mortgage their official government-assigned residences.
So they have to resort to secretly pawning off their outer properties, their real estate, just to afford the materials for the funerals.
They are even reduced to begging for favors and loans from former servants, like a man named Lai Shengrong, just to cover the travel expenses to bury their dead.
We are looking at a highly aristocratic, historically powerful family facing absolute public humiliation.
The source material uses this financial ruin to directly mirror the spiritual bankruptcy of the mortal world.
The grand estate is rotting from the inside out, just as the illusion of their importance is crumbling in the face of cosmic truth.
And Jia Zhang's solution to this impending bankruptcy is just the cruelest irony.
He looks at Baiyu, his son, who is still recovering from literally dying and traveling the cosmos, and says, you and your nephew Jia Lan need to start studying immediately for the imperial exams.
He insists that they need to memorize Confucian texts, pass the standardized exams, secure lucrative government positions, win back the family's honor, and, quote, redeem our crimes.
It is a moment of profound tragic irony. Baiyu has just returned from the true reality where he learned definitively and undeniably that earthly status, exam scores, bureaucratic titles, and government salaries are nothing but illusions.
They are the literal definition of the demonic barriers the monk warned him about.
Yet he is immediately thrust back into a family dynamic where mortgaging real estate and cramming for standardized tests are treated as matters of absolute life and death.
It's like finding out the universe is just a holographic simulation, and your father responds by telling you to make sure you get an A on your math test so you can get a good job as a banker inside the hologram.
It's absurd.
It is absurd, but Baiyu cannot argue. The system is too vast. He just has to submit to the grinding wheels of this societal machine, even though he knows the machine is broken and meaningless.
But this quiet submission to the bureaucracy comes at a devastating emotional cost to everyone who still cares about him. Because his enlightenment doesn't just isolate Baiyu, it deeply hurts the people who are still trapped in the illusion.
We see this most clearly in the aftermath of the coffins returning.
Yes. The maid Ziwan returns from her travels alongside Lin Daiyu's coffin. Now, we established earlier that Daiyu was the love of Baiyu's life.
The old Baiyu, the passionate fool, would have been completely destroyed by the sight of her coffin.
He would have thrown himself on it. He would have wept until he coughed up blood. He would have written endless mournful poetry.
But the awakened Baiyu, the enlightened soul who has seen the ledgers of fate.
He just sits there. He doesn't shed a single tear. He looks at the coffin containing the body of his soulmate, and he feels absolutely nothing.
Ziwan is weeping, completely devastated, mourning her mistress, and she looks over at Baiyu for comfort or shared grief, and he just coldly chuckles to himself.
It is an incredibly chilling image. It feels inhuman.
And it's not just his reaction to Daiyu's death. His entire personality has iced over.
Another maid, Wu'er, complains to Ziwan about it. She says, listen, Baiyu used to be famous in this house for how kindly he treated the girls.
He was so empathetic, always offering a kind word, always caring about our feelings.
But since he woke up from that illness, he won't even look at us. He treats us like we're invisible.
And Ziwan just laughs bitterly at that. And the text is unrelenting. It doesn't even let the family mourn this change in him in peace.
The conclusion of this segment leaves us with this brilliant, stressful cliffhanger. Just as the family is dealing with their overwhelming grief, their empty bank accounts, the looming stress of the imperial exams, and Baiyu's strange, cold new personality, the mysterious monk suddenly reappears at their front gates.
The catalyst of all this upheaval returns uninvited.
And he doesn't come offering spiritual comfort or wisdom. He stands at the gate shouting what the servants call crazy talk, and he demands a massive sum of money.
10,000 silver taels.
Lady Wang goes into an absolute panic. Jia Lian, the only guy who actually knows how to handle the bankrupt finances, isn't even home.
The infinite spiritual world and the bankrupt financial world have aggressively, violently collided right on their front lawn.
It's a perfect encapsulation of the dual nature of their reality. The ultimate divine messenger is standing at the gate, demanding literal physical currency from a family that has nothing left to give, spiritually or financially.